You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 450 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you in separate locations. I am in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
I'm Kevin Sheldon, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
People really had their minds blown by the Super Bowl 49ers thing. That was interesting. I assumed other people had thought of it when I said it, but they hadn't. It's the Jamie Moyer edition of the podcast, which is strange because the timing is off by 1 week. It could have been the Ichiro episode of the podcast to commemorate his induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame coming on Tuesday. One vote shy of unanimous.
Do you know what I call that episode?
If there was one, hold on, save it a second. If there was one response that people had to find out that Ichiro was in the Hall of Fame, it was, how is Tristan Carcino going to react to this?
It's so funny. I will get there, I guess. I don't. We could do it now.
Oh, we're doing it now.
Do you know what I call episode 51 or whatever, 451?
The Randy Johnson episode?
The Bruce Irvin edition.
Oh, okay.
The Randy Johnson edition. That's what I call it. It's so funny that people thought that I would have these hot takes about Ichiro being in the Hall of Fame. And I'm going to give the coldest take that I can give because Ichiro deserves it.
Really a spoiler alert to after the pod.
Are you ready for it? It's fine.
There was so much anticipation. People were upset that we released a terrific podcast with our friend Mike Sean Dugar from
The
Athletic.
I've already been through it. I laid out the facts years ago. My perspective about many things, human beings, you'll hear about this later, may contain multitudes. Just wait. I do not contain multitudes on each row. No, it's fine.
We at some point may need to record this podcast chronologically instead of confusing.
He was a good baseball player. He was over-glorified.
Are you willing to go far enough to say he was a very good baseball player?
He was a very good baseball player. The issue that I have with Ichiro is not that he wasn't a good baseball player, is that he's kind of viewed in the pantheon with excellent baseball players.
Well, I mean, should we talk about it? Like the fact that
we're having this conversation about it, first off, I do not care about things being unanimous in the Hall of Fame. There's nothing, like, if you're actually concerned with this is the thing that you actually care about. You might want to rethink some things because it just doesn't fucking matter.
If that was the thing that outraged you the most in the last week in the United States of America,
the things that people care, like the reason that people like Ichiro is it's not because of the playoff success or winning games, been established, didn't happen, but outside of year, it is because you have memories from this time period and Ichiro was the bright spot on the team. Ichiro was a very good and exciting baseball player playing baseball in the city of Seattle. It's probably very tied to the 2001 season when most people who are Mariners fans liked the Mariners. Me, on the other hand, did not like the Mariners. My feelings about Ichiro are also tied to the 2001 season, kind of, and objectively correct. But I didn't like the Mariners in 2001. I hated the Mariners in 2001, right? It's kind of funny that this whole time period happened. Probably the greatest team, obviously, I guess the greatest team in Seattle sports history, regular season wise, they kind of have to be.
I think it's safe to say none of the other teams have set the 2010 Storm did tie at that point the WNBA record for most wins in a regular season, but certainly not as long in story to history. There wasn't, you know, what the 1911 Chicago Cubs or whatever team it was the Mariners actually tied in 2001.
And so if you have good memories from Ichiro from that season and beyond, that's fine. You still have those memories. You still like Ichiro. In the same way that I have positive memories about Ken Griffey Jr. from the 90s, right? I still love Alex Rodriguez. My perspective about Alex Rodriguez didn't change over time. And whether he's unanimous in the Hall of Fame or not, it doesn't matter. To me, the biggest mockery and shame that happened is that much better baseball players are not in the Hall of Fame because of people trying to parse who did and who didn't do steroids, which is not a public fact or information. To me, the biggest outrage about this...
I think it is with Alex Rodriguez.
Some players it is, but it's not with everybody. Therefore, you can't judge only those players.
Right.
Because there are players in the Hall of Fame who have done steroids.
It's also a question of whether they did it when it was specifically banned. I do think you can draw some distinction there, but yes, I mean it's interesting. We'll talk more about this. I don't know if we want to when we want to transition to it, but like Felix's chances, and like it's tough to know exactly what to make of it because there are a number of players who have gotten into the Hall of Fame who have gotten much lower percentages in their first year of eligibility than Felix did, but partially because there was this period where there was a huge backlog of candidates who some voters were willing to vote for despite their either admitted steroid use or suspected steroid use. And some voters weren't. And now we're sort of out of that period where it's not as much voters running out of space on their ballot.
It's a stupid system. It is a stupid system that they have. And really, what the Hall of Fame is it's one weekend. It's to give a speech.
Well,
Like,
it's more than that.
if you going to Cooperstown, you know about the players. You're not like, oh my God, Ichiro says, I found myself in Cooperstown, New York.
I
I'd
think
love to learn more about this Ichiro.
you're
All of the
thinking.
information is available.
You're thinking too short term. You need to be thinking about this as like,
Are
if
you
there
like,
is,
damn, Cap Anson's that dude? It actually is insulting. I'm Cap Anson, maybe,
Oras had Ol Hoss Radbourne? Like,
the players
do
from
you think
back
there
in
would
the
be a Twitter
day,
account for
it is
him if he wasn't in
more
the Hall of Fame?
insulting for them being in the Hall of Fame. The most important thing about lots of those players is that they shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. And that's the notable thing about them. Is that what you want to be known for as the guy who accidentally ended up in the Hall of Fame? I mean, I guess it's better than being completely forgotten.
I mean, I suppose
Manny
I understand what you
Ramirez,
were
when
saying.
he was playing baseball, Alex Rodriguez, when he was playing baseball, was a better baseball player than Ichiro. Statistically speaking, Manny Ramirez is maybe debatable. A-Rod is not really debatable.
A-Rod is
A-Rod,
unquestionably not debatable. If you're asking like who was the best baseball player who played
what
for the
is the
Mariners, it does have
difference?
to be A-Rod.
What is the difference between these things? Because we're going through this, like, strange backdoor arguments about steroids that some people agree with and some people don't. Alex Rodriguez is in the Hall of Fame. To me, the whole fucking thing is bullshit. So
Wow, your whole system is out of order.
that's why I say for Ichiro, it's fine.
All right, well,
I'm not mad about Ichiro being in the Hall of Fame. Of course he was going to be in the Hall of Fame. I don't care whether he had unanimous votes or didn't have unanimous votes. The whole thing is halls of fame are dumb.
be careful.
It's
You're
marketing. If
going to
be
talk
careful.
yourself into our your my statue take.
Yeah, fine. I'm fine with that. A statue means more. A statue is about celebrating a moment that happened a lot of times in the city that it happened in. That's what this is about. It's about remembering that moment that happened. I thought it was cool going to Baltimore and seeing the Brooks Robinson statue. I personally thought that was a cool thing to see. I
Did
know
you
that
see the
cold
B&O
dead.
warehouse
What about it?
where
Okay, wait a
Griffey hit the
minute.
wall?
Oh, did I see it? You know
Yeah.
what? I didn't specifically go look for it, but I'm
Wow.
sure I did. I was walking all around there.
Okay.
That I actually thought it was cool to be there and be like, this moment happened here. Hall of Fame is, it's a speech. That's what it is. It's a banquet. We're celebrating a banquet. A banquet and a stupid plaque. Come on. Who cares?
Well, many people do care.
Am I
So we.
wrong? Am I wrong about this?
You're not totally wrong about this. I mean, I don't think it.
Alex, when they
Ichiro is not the
played the
play.
games, Alex Rodriguez and Manny Ramirez were some of the greatest and most notable baseball players during this time period. Put people in the Hall of Fame for what they did, not because you're punishing them. That's this idea of it's punishment. For what? For what? Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame.
I agree that Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. Like, Ichiro was not the place to have this conversation. It was Edgar really was the place to have this conversation because obviously it did mean a lot to a lot of people. But it's like, would Edgar's career have been any less if he was not voted into the Hall of Fame? And my answer to that is no. So that's where I think I would agree with your point. We should talk about the unanimous aspect because of the fact that it was the only drama here. It was not any question that Ichiro was going to make the Hall of Fame. He fell one vote shy of unanimous. Mariano Rivera remains the only unanimous selection. Derek Jeter was also one vote shy, while Ken Griffey Jr. was three votes shy. And I have to assume that the reason that any of these players weren't unanimous is entirely because people are like, well, if Babe Ruth wasn't unanimous, then this person shouldn't be.
Gets
So,
together and does that though. Because what you're saying is
but
the
nobody
committee.
gets together and does that.
Well, if only one guy thought it, then he has to be the guy. Because everybody else, if you these know, are blind ballots, sorry, one person, I don't want to say guy.
I think the BBWAA, the rules of eligible Hall of Fame voters, the demographics do speak for themselves, but yes.
But if one person decided that, it's not like the whole committee got together and was like, well, Babe Ruth wasn't unanimous, therefore we have to stop this. That means that one person out of, what is the number, 300 and...
Isn't 355, 354, I think.
One person out of those group of people thinks that. If you're the Hall of Fame, you probably should be rethinking...
394.
Out of 394 people, if one person thinks that, you probably should be thinking that, rethinking that person's ability to be voting for this. If they're like, I have to take it upon myself. Like, I talked myself into a take. What a fucking asshole. That's like, I have to be the person to stop this from happening.
I want to be careful with endorsing taking away ballots for people who happen to keep things from being unanimous.
You just find, like, I know you want... You have an anti-Seattle bias for your things.
An anti-Italian-American from Seattle. It's well established.
You're like, we've learned a lot of institutions aren't principled this last week. That is not a thing that we have learned about ESPN senior writer Kevin Felton.
You can't say no, vote my conscience.
Cannot be swayed. That's so funny. But like, if that's the person who's like, I need to stop this, because that's what it is. It's not like they looked at it and they were like, but
Ichiro is not, because it's very different. Like, the is Ichiro a Hall of Famer, yes or no, as opposed to, is this player the best rookie or is this other player the best rookie?
But I agree. I personally think all of the people who are holding it against A-Rod, it's absurd. It is absurd that that is what we're doing. Because we're not talking about the best baseball player. Again, the things that matter are our memories. A plaque, YouTube videos, that shit is what actually goes down. It's not being in the Hall of Fame. It's a footnote.
John Boyce's Mariners movies.
I've said this consistently about the perfect game. Armando Galarraga, give it to him. You know what I mean? Like, one of the best perfect games of all time. Because what matters? Pedro Martinez. Those are the best perfect games. That's what matters more, is the being in the thing with everybody else. Whatever. Who cares?
Well, speaking about perfect games, Felix Hernandez was at 20.6% of the vote in his first year on the ballot.
How is Felix not a Hall of Famer?
Well, I hate to point this out to you, Mr. Ichiro critic, but the lack of postseason appearances does work against Felix, and just the fact that he didn't really have that long of a career, all things considered. Like, the period between his peak and when he was out of baseball entirely was relatively short, I think.
So basically what the Hall of Fame is just you hung around.
It's not just you hung around, but definitely that's an easy way to accumulate war, which is now a big factor in Hall of Fame voting. But I think his chances are pretty good. Like, this puts him in the mix. Seven eventual Hall of Famers have started with a lower share of the vote, including recent inductees Todd Helton, Scott Rolen, and this year Billy Wagner. Albeit none faster than their sixth year of eligibility. So, like, the funny thing is, like, we're talking about Felix now. We're not going to know for, like, 7 years. Based on what happens to his vote in 2032, then we'll know with Felix.
I mean, he had a time period where, with Safeco Field, it wasn't the same kind of, like...
It was a pitcher's park, but it wasn't as extreme as it plays now.
He was one of, if not the most dominant pitcher in the AL for basically like a period of 7 years or something like that.
7 years?
I mean, he was top...
Like, over a 7-year span or for each of those 7 years?
Like, in the 7-year span, he was top 10 in Cy Young voting 6 times.
Okay.
That's a whole generation of baseball. That he didn't hang around after, Tim Lincecum should be in the Hall of Fame. Tim Lincecum was the most dominant pitcher in baseball. That should be worth something. But the problem is we're talking about a stupid institution from the beginning that doesn't put the best baseball players in. And that's why the whole fucking thing doesn't matter. If I'm Tim Lincecum, I don't even want to be in a Hall of Fame that won't let A-Rod in, that won't let Manny Ramirez in, that won't let Pete Rose in.
I don't want to be a member of any Hall of Fame that would have me as a member.
Exactly. So, but you understand, like, to be the most, I understand their conflicting arguments, but what they've settled on is baseball players, you're like, oh, okay. Like Billy Wagner, it's like, he's pretty good. He's a really closer. Helped me win my fantasy season in that first year that we did it on our own.
Oh, wow.
When
there
closers were super dominant. Is Rob Nen in the Hall of Fame too? Probably is.
He is not. Trevor Hoffman is.
Trevor Hoffman, I think, might have been part of it also. But I'm like, Billy Wagner? That's what they've settled on. They've settled on above-average baseball players who play for a long time. Cool.
Well, on a more somber note this week,
I think I'm going to be hot all of 2025 for obvious reasons.
Maybe all the way through 2028.
Only January.
On a more somber note this week, we're remembering Sonics legend Gus Williams, who died last Wednesday at age 71. The Wizard was a two-time All-Star, two-time All-NBA pick during six seasons with the Sonics, as well as the leading scorer on the only championship team in franchise history in 1979. His number one jersey was retired in 2004 as part of celebrating the 25th anniversary of the title. Williams suffered a stroke in 2020, and care for him, along with fellow former Sonics point guard Slick Watts, led to the creation of the Sonics Legends Fund, which is helping out with funding Gus Williams' funeral now as well. So, you know, I think if you want to make a donation, that's probably a good place to direct yours. I did on behalf of the Pelton cast. You know, Gus Williams obviously was someone who came around. You know, I was two at the time he was traded. You were not yet born when he last played for the Sonics, but certainly a figure who loomed legendary in Sonics history in Seattle basketball, you know, well beyond his career and to the point where we were fans and then eventually working for the team in my case.
Definitely. Yeah, and I always come back to, like, obviously not having seen Gus Williams play and the amount of there is footage from this time period, but not a ton.
I mean, famously, besides being the leading scorer, he also was the one who had the ball at the end of game five
and threw
against
it in the
Bullets in 1979. Yeah.
Threw it straight up. But the Gus Williams shirt that I had, I think Jan must have bought this around the, like,
I think it would have been in 2004 when his jersey got retired, I'm pretty sure.
The 04 season. It's one of my favorite shirts that you still have.
The other thing I think back on is, you know, I happened to randomly see a photo about the creation of Powell Barnett Park when I was doing some research the other day on Wikipedia. And then also saw, I think, friend of the pod, Kevin Jackson, my former colleague at ESPN, posted a photo of him with DJ. I don't know if it was him, but a photo of DJ and Gus Williams, the backcourt from the championship team, who were honored together as part of the 40th anniversary Sonics Legend Tour at Powell Barnett Park, an event. You know, I was at all of those, obviously, working for the team, but you intended that as well because there was a UW football game later that day, I'm pretty sure, that we went to.
I remember being great.
Yeah. And tragically, DJ passed away later that year. You know, while we were still celebrating the Sonics 40th anniversary. And it's kind of hard to believe that now, from the 79 championship team, Jack Sikma is the only remaining living starter from that team. And, you know, we commemorated that on the 40th anniversary in 2019. I put together a two-part podcast series on the 79 championship and everything that led up to it. Wasn't able to get Gus for a full interview, but he was there in either late May or early June around the anniversary of the June 1st championship. The Mariners held an event honoring the 79 championship team, and Gus Williams was there, his last public appearance in Seattle before that stroke caused his health to decline, and was able to get a few minutes with him and put him in that podcast. So it was really an honor and a pleasure, and definitely thinking of Gus Williams and his family. All right, back to jersey retirements. And congrats to Kelsey Plum, whose number 10 jersey was retired at halftime of Saturday's UW women's basketball game.
Hello.
Win over Purdue. This was a really fun event. UW athletic department did a great job of making it feel like a big deal. There was a good crowd in the building. The team played tremendously well. We'll talk about that later. Didn't carry over, unfortunately, but and Plum, really seemed to be taking it all in and appreciating the moment in both her speech and then her comments to the media afterward.
That's awesome. How was the speech? How long did it last?
Only a couple of minutes because he did it during
That's
halftime.
perfect.
So the whole speech, the whole ceremony, we were told was supposed to run 12 minutes, and I don't think it ran over. So she really spoke longer than to media than she spoke actually on the court for only a minute or two.
Excellent. Great. And the greatest UW women's basketball player of all time. Probably, I think we've parsed this, probably the greatest UW basketball player of all time.
Bob Hoobriggs and her are the competition. If you want to say the fact that Kelsey Plum has had a more successful pro career than Hoobriggs separates her, like if you're counting both, I think then it has to be Kelsey Plum.
And was Bob Hoobriggs the all-time leading scorer when he retired? Like, I mean,
In college basketball history?
yeah,
No.
that's a standard that, in the same way for the Mariners to have been probably the greatest Seattle sports regular season of all time, it's almost impossible to, unless somebody breaks it. But when she retired, scoring's not the only thing, but she basically achieved the most of any player in UW women's basketball history and UW basketball history.
No, sadly, what Kelsey Plum did not do is announce that she's coming back to the Storm in free agency.
I mean, it
They
would have been
said
a
beforehand,
strange thing to have
no,
done.
obviously she's not going to do that. They said beforehand, no questions about free agency.
They did. I mean, also, it's just like this is about celebrating her time at UW, right?
It
And
would have been amazing timing. I am not expecting
there are
Kelsey Plum.
contracts to deal with and shit like that.
I
Like
know.
that's the thing.
I'm not
It would
saying like
have
for
the
her to
pit
announce it. I'm
ink
just saying.
would have had to have been dried to have behind the scenes, which is free agency open in
Free
the
agency
WNBA.
started on Tuesday, so 3 days
Okay.
after, or Monday, I think. So, yeah, no,
So she would
Tuesday,
have
so 2
had to
days
have
after.
already had it negotiated enough that you feel confident announcing it. Like,
No, I don't think that she should have done, or I expected that she was going to do it. But I am not at this point anticipating that Kelsey Plum will be a member of the Storm in 2025.
what is the, where do you think she ends up? Back in Vegas?
I don't know if I want to go into it at the present moment. But not Seattle.
Wow. Okay. Heard loud and clear.
Very possible that Jewel Loyd ends up in Vegas, though. So there you go. All right.
I'm doing the Larry David looking in your eyes to try to understand what you're saying. Is there there's smoke around Jewel Loyd to Vegas?
We did a piece on ESPN.com today looking at the best fits for free agents. And then we also threw in Jewel Loyd because of the trade request. And I picked Vegas as the best fit. And
What is the package in return if it doesn't include Kelsey? Because Kelsey Plum can't be traded. It would have to be a sign and trade.
Kelsey
Is that a
Plum,
thing in the WNBA?
it is a thing that
Okay.
is very much a thing this year. Many of the players who got cored are going to get signed and traded.
Ugh.
I don't
The
anticipate that.
league's really grown up.
It's happened before. I don't anticipate that with Gabby Williams, for the record. Natasha Howard, the Storm did it with back in 2021. I do think whatever Vegas gets in return for Kelsey Plum could come to Seattle for Jewel Loyd. And then the question is whether that would, whatever players and picks that would be, whether that makes sense for the Storm or whether there's even more teams involved.
You think that you're saying that you think there's smoke around Kelsey Plum, or you know information that you're not telling us around Kelsey Plum being traded, signed and traded to somebody else. And then
I think it's a logical outcome.
is it a West Coast team?
I don't want to get into it.
It's not the Liberty, right?
No, I don't think Kelsey Plum's going to the Liberty. If anyone's going to the Liberty, it's going to be Satu Savale. But
Is it the Sparks? Does that make sense?
so congrats to UW Indoor Track's Nathan Green. Led 9 Huskies under 4 minutes in the Miles City event Saturday at Dempsey Indoor by setting a school record of 3 minutes, 50 seconds, 0.74, the fastest mile in the world so far this year.
Wow.
I mean,
Is
this is
it done?
relatively
Is the
early
thing
in
you're
the year.
talking about done?
No, nothing is done.
It's just smoke.
Yes.
Okay.
So
Interesting.
again, it'd be, it's cool to be such a fast school as opposed to the team down south where they
Yes.
just don't run as fast as they do at
Wow, I even
UW
got you calling them the team down south.
in this one particular instance.
There we go. Just a slow school, it's fine. I mean, we saw their basketball team, they're strong. You know what I mean? They're a big team, but they're just not fast.
Burly, but quite
That's
physical,
it.
yeah.
That's what we're known for up here in Seattle, is speed. We're more of a track college. It's kind of the way that I like to think of it.
When the football team goes to the college football playoff final, that's just a bonus.
Yeah, no, I mean we're all about speed and, you know, winning gold medals. But you know, like regular seasons, similar to the 2001 Mariners season, like I just think honestly, like we should really honor really good regular seasons around here for slow schools. But when you get to the playoffs, speed matters. So, you know, maybe look at there in the Big Ten.
All right, lastly, a quick note. Wanted to throw this out here. The Storm sent out a release earlier that they are partnering with Deep Blue Sports to support women impacted by the fire in Los Angeles. And there will be donation boxes located outside the Storm Center for Basketball Performance for those who wish to drop off and donate women's hygiene products. Those are going to be available Friday during business hours. They started earlier in the week, and then Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon at the Storm Center for Basketball Performance, which is 1616 West Bertona Avenue. All right, you.
I think we should also mention a toast to three Seattle area players who won a national championship this last week in the Big
Oh, that's a
Ten.
good point. Yeah,
Between
yeah,
Emeka Ogbuka,
Emeka Ogbuka, yeah.
JT Tuimoloau, and G. Scott Jr., three players who, granted, I obviously would have loved for all of them to have stayed home and played at UW, but you kind of can't fault somebody for going to Ohio State at that
Especially,
point.
they didn't realize they were already in Big Ten country. Who would have known at that point?
And to have, you know, finished it off with a national championship, all of them being involved, Emeka Ibuka for a second being involved maybe negatively, all of them being involved in that game. JT Tuimoloau had a sack. Like they were players from the Seattle area who all had an impact on the game. I was telling Miss Fantasy Genius, I was like, there's somebody from Eastside Catholic who won a national championship on Monday.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, Taye High School still locked out.
Same with Mount Rainier.
Not just yet, soon.
Do you have time to do cookies?
Yeah, let's just do it fast.
All right, our search for Seattle's best cookie is back underway. Last week, I was able to go to a bake shop in Lower Queen Anne. Just a couple of blocks away from Climate Pledge Arena. I didn't really realize until they were on the infatuations list of Seattle's best chocolate chip cookies that I could have been searching there. Although they
I
have
could have
sort of
been
a
searching there.
they sort of have a split identity. They're by day a bakery and cafe, and then at night, so when I was actually down there, a dessert and wine bar. Although they only run that during the spring and summer, and not currently during the winter. You can't go there at night. But they have a variety of cookies depending on the day. But their specialty, the salted espresso chocolate chip, which we tried. The Infatuation rankings also referenced a miso buckwheat chocolate chip. We didn't. That wasn't there when I went, but we did ha also have a smaller miso snickerdoodle that we split in half for the two of us.
I thought you were going to say that they were a techno club at night.
Know, they could be a weed store by night if you're the bake shop,
There we
right?
go.
That
I
was
thought
the
you were going to be
plan.
like Seattle's hottest club is Bake Shop.
This place has everything. Miso.
I'd been here before. I'm pretty sure that I had their cookie as well. It might have
Oh,
even
really?
been while we were searching for Seattle's best cookie.
And you just didn't mention it? You were
I don't
having
it
recreational
must have
cookies?
been before then. Oh, I'd be eating cookies. Did I ever talk about the Met Market peanut butter cookie?
I don't think we ever got into it on the pod. I still need to have it, though.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't had it yet.
I'm just gonna throw this out there. It's
Yeah.
really good. It is really good.
I doubt it. I don't doubt it.
It is so chock full of peanuts, unlike any cookie I've ever had. It is a shockingly unique cookie for a grocery store. It does make me think, like, the cookie, probably pretty good. Because I had it after hours too, where like the bakery was closed
And
and
so
they
it
just had a
wasn't like
bunch, they
fresh.
were just sitting out. I think it maybe ended up being like a little bit more dry than I would have liked it to because of that, but it's still, I was eating it and I was like, there's no info about what's in it online, really. And I was like, I might be allergic to this risk. And die. Yeah, I no, I was like, I ate a bite and I was like, pretty freaking good.
Did you wait until you got home and you had an EpiPen handy?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But I was like, I think I'm fine. No, I was driving. I was in the viaduct. I knew however far it was to an exit in each direction in the tunnel. So something happened. It was either 130 one way or 40 the other way.
It's, that's not the correct numbers, but I like that whatever. You still refer to it as the viaduct.
Yeah. Like Safeco Field. The bake shop, however, so
that's different. The ballpark is still the same. They just changed the name of Safeco Field. They literally tore that sucker down with the viaduct and built something entirely different that goes underground instead of above the ground. It's the exact opposite of the viaduct in many ways.
I call it the Bruce Irvin edition.
We're definitely getting better at this.
The bake shop cookies are good. They are good cookies, in my opinion, for a bakery. And I think that is where it stops. I think they're in fact, I might even say that they're very good. Right. But as far as competition for Seattle's best cookie, it's a different level that you have to be able to get to. And the competition's very, very high. And I ate it with glee, the cookies. But it still is just not at the level of some of the cookies that are going into the bracket, in my opinion.
I thought they were maybe closer. My partner was a big fan of this because I gave her, you know, half to try. And I if it was a little thicker, it's like, you know, my preferred chocolate chip cookie is a little thicker. These are pretty thin cookies. But for a thin cookie, I thought it was quite good.
Yeah. No, and again, these are, if you're there, if I'm around Bake Shop, I like everything about Bake Shop also. I like
except
the whole experience
that it's not a techno club at night.
Well, I'm fine with that, actually.
So maybe you want three identities. You know, baked goods during the morning and afternoon. Then, you know, in the early evening, it's the wine bar. And wine then bar. After hours,
yeah,
that's when the party really starts at Bake Shop.
Yeah.
We should,
or the weed
we should,
store, whatever.
We should do marketing for Bake Shop.
Sean Kemp Cannabis is right there. So I don't want to take away business from Sean Kemp Cannabis.
They're not that close to each other, are they?
Like probably less than a mile.
I mean, less than a mile, but it's not like, you know, oh, I can walk. I would park one place and walk from one to the other. I probably wouldn't do that.
I just don't want to take away business from Sean Kemp Cannabis. Okay.
Understandable.
Your definition of not that close. How close do you need your weed stores?
I'm just saying it's not like they're on the same block as each other.
Fair enough.
It's not like I'm saying, hey, let's open a hamburger place, you know, and the old Blockbuster right next to the Dick's.
I'm looking at exactly how far we are.
Give me the walking distance. Is it under 15 minutes? It's probably under 15 minutes.
It's absolutely under 15 minutes.
It's probably under 10.
It's close. It is 0.4 miles, a 9-minute walk.
Okay.
Between the two. So
I think Sean Kemp Cannabis is going to do fine either
way. I guess it's just Kemp's Cannabis now. I thought it was Sean Kemp Cannabis, but Kemp's Cannabis. I don't even know if he's actually paid personally from the individual cannabis sales, but I hope he is.
I think he does have an ownership stake. How large that is, I'm not sure. All right. Anything else on Bake Shop?
Yeah, I think it's really good, but not quite at the level of bracket worthy.
It's a 1-star for 1P for sure, and maybe even a little bit better than that. But yeah, I don't think, because at this point, if we consider Met Market to be in the bracket based on the peanut butter cookie,
I think we probably should. To me, the peanut butter cookie was good enough to put them in the bracket.
Then we have 8 right now already. We have a full bracket. We're going to have to bump something out. And there is, like, we still have Cardoon to go to, which is pretty highly regarded and looks quite good. So
I think that's the thing about Bake Shop is, like, again, the standards just are extraordinarily high at this point.
The Pelton Cast, our standards are extraordinarily high.
I've clarified that it is called Sean Kemp's Cannabis.
Good to know. Good to know. Many, you know, I'm sure if you type in Kemp's hemp cannabis or whatever. You won't find it
It's
in.
kind of, it looks like they kind of function as both. Like on the logo says Sean Kemp's Cannabis, but the website's kempscannabis.com.
Fair enough. Should we get into Seattle
Not
sports?
great consistency in their branding, people. Come on.
So we should be doing marketing for them too.
yeah.
Should we form a consultancy?
I mean, don't you have a marketing degree, a
I do
business
have a
major with a
marketing
marketing
degree.
degree?
Yeah, business degree with concentration
It's
in
literally
marketing.
basically my job is marketing. So it's not that, like,
Far-fetched.
yes.
No, I think it's more the idea that we're not that we already have jobs. We're pretty busy.
That our day job isn't podcaster. Can you believe it?
Like to think of us like the Men in Blazers when you find out that Roger Davis is actually running all of late night.
Yeah, just as large of a fan
Roger,
base
it's
too.
Michael Davis. I don't know why I called him Roger, but I know why I called him Roger Davis, but I conflated the two there.
All right.
Mariners news. Prospect lists are coming out. The Mariners had an
Hello.
MLB high 7 players in the Baseball America top 100. And they ranked Colt Emerson number 16. I think they said, take this, Tristan, when you say the Mariners have no high upside prospects.
I definitely did not say that. Oh my God. I did not say the Mariners don't have any high upside prospects. And that's also such as all prospects have a high upside.
I mean, not all prospects have a high upside, but yes, the being a very likely prospect to be good is not the same as having a high upside. Yes.
I mean that's pretty good. Number 16. Being in the top 10 is still higher. I still think that the player that they draft with their first round draft pick probably will end up being ranked higher next year than Colt Emerson is this year. But this is all good things. None of this is bad. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying the Mariners, all prospects, I'm happy about all of it, the
So
information.
in addition to Cole Emerson, we've got Cole Young at 56, Johnny Farmelo at 70, Michael Arroyo at 77, Felton Celestin at 89, Harry Ford at 95, and Lazaro Montez at 97. All right, Seattle Kraken have won two in a row on their current
Hello,
homestand.
that's it for the Mariners?
I don't know. Do you have other Mariners stuff?
I mean, I guess the Mariners are stopping us from having other Mariners stuff, but
It's not been a busy week. I mean, I think they probably have one more move left in them, but
I'm curious, I do we think Colt Emerson is going to be in the major leagues at some point this year?
some of these lists do kind of the what year, the
Expected MLB day.
expected. I don't I mean the actual Baseball America list is behind a paywall, so I've only seen the lists. The players, I should say, projected to debut in 2026.
I mean, he is 19 years old. Colt Emerson is very young.
Emerson, CBS Sports says late summer, so plausible.
I do wonder how much of with Colt Emerson, and he's probably long term the J.P. Crawford replacement, right? But how much of the Mariners' lack of urgency with regard to middle infield has to do with them thinking Colt Emerson, which I'm not saying is a great plan, but them thinking that they don't want to clog that path for Colt Emerson, that if he's good enough, he has to force them to, he has to push them, but to make sure that there's a place for him to play.
I mean, he wasn't very good last year in the time he played at Everett, which is high A ball. I mean, look, he was good at Modesto, which is A ball. And the thing is, him being at high A ball at his age, one of the cool things that Baseball Reference does on the minor league pages is your age relative to the average age of the league you're playing in. Do you want to
Yes.
know how much younger he was?
Was it minus like 2.0 or something?
He laughs at your minus 2.0. He was 3.1 years younger than the average
Whoa.
for A ball. At high A ball, 4.4 years younger.
Whoa. All right.
And then even in Arizona Fall League, because Colt Emerson, I guess he did turn 19 during the season, but it was considered his age 18 season by Baseball Reference. When he debuted for the Mariners, he may have already turned 17, but he was seven. He was 18. I mean, but he was 17 when he was drafted, so he is incredibly young. And this is maybe something to keep in mind when you're thinking about the Mariners' timetable, that this is part of why they're not. We need to go sign Pete Alonso tomorrow. It's like they're trying to win in 2028, and you can debate whether that's the right strategy or not. But I do think that is part of their logic. It's
This is a
just,
playoff team
it does
right
just help
now.
them be cheap.
This Mariners team is a playoff team right now. We'll get to the takes as we get later into the season, but that is the thing that I think is missing on people being like, oh, the Mariners screwed up this offseason or whatever. And it's just like, sometimes when you have a pretty good young roster, the best thing to do is just not fuck it up. And
I believe a wise man said, just wait.
well, that's for hating.
I'm aware, but sometimes it can work for
Look,
loving as well.
if you're wanting to hate on the Mariners, you probably are not going to have to wait that long. The hate usually happens pretty quickly, and in a baseball season, it could happen as soon as day one.
Believe it's when
So,
Tommy La Stella starts day on
yeah,
opening day. That's when it happens.
all of a sudden, the hate can creep in early.
No
But
holes.
I just looking at this roster, not that many. Like Victor Robles went right for them last year. Cal Raleigh had a good season. It wasn't like
Well, I mean,
offensively
if we're offensively, no, but if we're talking
that's.
about things that went right, the health of the starting pitchers.
Castillo missed time.
I sure do. Have you looked around Major League Baseball at the health of starting pitchers?
The thing
They
about the Mariners pitching is that.
literally like convened a study about how often pitchers are getting injured.
They have six capable pitchers. It's funny, Luca was doing a pitching lesson a couple weeks ago, and the coach was like, who's your favorite baseball pitcher? And he said he was getting yelled at the entire time, of course. And he said, Jose Berrios. And I was just like, what the fuck? And I'm like, the Mariners have six pitchers that you could have named right now. I mean, you probably wouldn't say Emerson Hancock, but you came up with Jose Berrios. And I was like, you pitch like Bryce Miller, like George Kirby. And the name that you came up with was Jose Berrios. This coach, of course, yelled at him the entire lesson. But like after, I was just like, why the fuck did you pick Jose Berrios as the person?
I appreciate his commitment to intellectual diversity.
Just the most random player after we gave him a lecture about it, and basically it was like he's only been saying like Kirby and Miller since then, and his coach also thinks that George Kirby throws too many strikes, so but it was like just say this because that's going to be the best answer that people want to hear. Jose Ber like the amount that any random person knows about Jose Berrios is going to be very little.
You could have given me a lot of guesses on who he played for Jose Berrios, and
I don't
I was
even, he
not going to
told me,
get.
and I don't even know if I remember.
He's on the Toronto Blue Jays.
Okay, I kind of think I knew that. But I also had a thought about the Ichiro thing when he throws the ball four times and knocks over the bats. And I was like, I feel like most major leaguers can do that. Like, with enough time. Like, if you're recording a video for social media, I'm like, the ability to throw a ball and knock over four bats in a row is not that impressive.
I didn't see this video, so your
It was
reference
from
is
the
lost on me.
outfield, sure. But it was like from the mound to home plate. And I'm like, there are a lot of players who could do this.
Anything else on the Mariners?
I'm excited. I can feel it in the air. We've had a very, no pun intended, dry January. And it's feeling the sun is going down a
Oh,
little bit later.
it's light after 5 p.m.
You
It's
noticing this?
legitimately exciting. I mean,
It
especially out
feels
here.
like baseball out there.
We're on the coast. The sun sets later for us than it
Oh
does for
yeah.
you inland.
So it's like 7:38 for you now out there on the coast. So I am itching for baseball. It's so funny that 2001 Mariners, I was like, yeah, fuck this. The 2025 Mariners, though, I'm like, bring it on.
The more that you can have your opinion contrasted with casual Mariners fans, the
It
better
was,
for
and
you.
that's not even true though, because there are like the bandwagon's fairly big right now.
But I'm saying that the bandwagon is not big with people who are like, hey, I'm excited for this 2025 Mariners season.
Oh, come
Can't
on.
wait. The
Come on.
bandwagon is full of people who are like, John Stanton needs to sell the team immediately.
I agree with
Which
those
is,
people
they're not
also.
wrong, but
Was John
I.
Stanton the owner when they blocked the or fought against the
No, he was
that
not the
was a different
majority owner.
thing.
So he was part of the ownership group the entire time, but he was not serving as CEO or, the
Okay.
chairman at that point.
I'm sure he was probably down for the idea, but it's just like, I'm
I
so sick of
mean,
people fucking scared to compete. People don't, human beings don't have enough Pete Carroll in them. Compete with them. Go be better than the Sonics. You're that scared about the competition. It's fucking bullshit. The same with some of these social media apps where you're just like, you're so fucking scared of competition. Do better. That's what capitalism is supposed to be about.
I want other Seattle sports and food podcasts out there because we can crush them.
Crush them all.
Bring back the beast bone. Come
We're
on.
Fine. Or just don't care. That's the main thing. You exactly. don't have to crush them. You can also not care about these things, just like the Hall of Fame vote.
We did love our friends at Taste for Profanity when they were recording. No, I mean, Stanton was also part of the Sonics ownership group under Howard Schultz. Like, he's not like anti-Sonics. He was, again, not the majority owner at that point. He organized the 40th anniversary. I mean, not him personally, but, you know, the 40th anniversary celebration that I referenced earlier of the 79 championship.
John
was out there wearing
How
his...
How dare you say positive things about John
was
Stanton?
Was on the field wearing his Sonics jersey.
He would beat multitudes.
You beat me to it. You beat me to it. All right, Seattle Kraken have won two in a row on their current home stand. And the question is that a good thing? They're still 6 points out of the playoffs, would need to pass three other teams to make it. So I don't know. I'm probably on team. Let's play for the lottery right now. But I don't know how you feel about this because you, sir, are attending a Seattle Kraken game.
I am.
Lifelong Kraken fan.
And the way that I care about it is I don't care at all.
Oh, wow.
I mean, like,
the way you approach the decision is indifference.
Well, I mean, if the Kraken win, that's going to be great. And if the Kraken lose, it's not going to affect my day. The idea that you would be tanking at this point of the season, I think, is a little bit too early to be bothered by two wins in a row.
I know. I'm
like, if the Kraken get hot and make a playoff push, great. Are they going to beat the Capitals? Probably not. But you never know.
Oh, maybe it's one hockey game.
Yeah.
How long could it last, Michael? 85 minutes?
I don't think that the Caps have lost that many games, but again, if the Kraken lose, that's fine. I'm going to enjoy going and watching hockey. It's like going to the, you understand the assignment. When you go to the Blazers game, you cheer for the Blazers.
Kraken only make one trip between now and February 8th. I didn't realize this before looking at their schedule. They're headed to Edmonton on Monday as part of a road home back-to-back that breaks up these two homestands that are otherwise, you know, pretty contiguous.
I'm calling it right now. The run is coming. Kraken playoffs 2025.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that a bold
Starting
prediction?
Today. No, that is They're not all a
gonna,
bold prediction.
It's going to be like when the Mariners had that surge in August after the famous cousin Katie's husband drove all the way from where we were staying in Central Washington to T-Mobile Park to attend a game and back.
Me going from Renton to Seattle in extraordinarily good seats is basically the same thing.
Same level of commitment. You attending a hockey game.
I told Luca, I was like, you remember the Blazers game that we went to last month? Those seats that we were in? And I was like, this is the exact opposite of that.
I mean, Luca has been in Diamond Club seats, hasn't he? He understands how the other half live.
He has. No, Diamond Club's better than the Kraken Club tickets. But the view of hockey is better at this.
That's probably true. Yeah. All right, Seattle Sounders now in Marbella, Spain, to continue their preseason training. Jesus Ferreira joined the team prior to the trip after withdrawing from his scheduled appearance at the USMNT National Camp, working back to 100%. Sounders played their first preseason match Thursday versus Puskas Academia FC, winning 2-0 with Paul Areola starting and a goal and an assist from Pedro de la Vega. As many starters played the first half, Jordan Morris converted the de la Vega assist and Joao Paulo set up De La Vega's goal.
There we go. Wait, Luca, come here.
What are you going to ask him about the Diamond Club?
Favorite baseball pitcher is.
Oh, okay.
See what he says. And how many tries it would take to knock over four bats if you put them out. I'm on a podcast, yeah.
Oh, yeah. We'll
oh wow. He's hyped. He thinks we're asking about the West Coast Conference. Come here. Okay. Who is your favorite baseball pitcher?
George Kirby.
Wow, there we go. He learned. I was saying you said Jose Berrios before.
Bro, shut up.
I got a bro shut up. What is it about Jose Berrios that you loved so much?
That's
you don't even have an
podcasting.
Answer. This is just
dynamite
like being with Dave. Didn't even have an answer.
You're letting the people know about Dave.
I just said that you were yelled at through the things. How many tries would it take? Okay, let's say that you set up four bats behind home plate and you were standing at the mound. How many tries do you think it would take for you to knock over all four bats in a row throwing the ball?
A lot.
You're supposed to say none. One try. You think it would take how? You think you could knock over a bat from the mound?
We'll go down to school and try it.
Yeah, we're gonna try.
Okay.
I'm gonna film it for social media.
All right.
About how Luke is better than Ichiro.
Bro, shut up. We don't care about Ichiro.
We do care about Ichiro, actually, is the thing.
Why am I looking at Cold Emerson? We should all be looking at Cold Emerson.
Wow.
Why are you not looking at Cold Emerson?
Why are you looking at Cold Emerson?
Because he's the number 16 prospect in baseball. Thank you.
U12 Baseball World Cup.
Did he? This motherfucker's like almost as young as you are. You better watch your back.
This guy's 19 years old.
If you made it, if you made it to the majors, you would play at the same time as Cold Emerson. And like you would be peers. He's only 7 years older than you are.
Both like the same difference as me.
You better get going.
What in the I'm fucking sorry. I'm 12 years old, my guy. I'm a seventh grader.
My guy?
He was already playing in Modesto as a seventh grader.
You really sometimes at some point, Tristan, probably need to consider what Luca is going to say about you on a podcast that he eventually hosts.
Wendy, it's going to be with me.
Oh, wow. He'll be roasting you on your own podcast.
Okay, well, Cold Emerson was drafted when he was 17. That's 5 years from now for you.
It's 5 years of a tail will be my age.
So? Okay, just make sure that you're the 22nd overall selection and pass up Auburn.
Yeah, and be a shortstop.
And be a shortstop.
Yeah, I don't like the odds on that one.
Okay, Luka changed.
It's good that Luka knows his own strengths and weaknesses. All right, Seattle Reign FC, NWSL, has announced the 2025 regular season schedule. The Reign will host Gotham FC in their season opener March 15th. Notable because it's Pitt's Lynn Biendolo against her former team in her Reign debut, the former Lynn Williams, as we knew her at the time of the trade, now going by her married name, Biendolo, after her December wedding to a former Pepperdine point guard,
really?
Native of Australia.
All right. Yeah.
And winner of Big Brother Australia, I believe.
Oh, wow.
Quite a resume for Marley Biendolo. So very interesting to go down that rabbit hole. No matches in all of July as the NWSL makes room for continental championships. And the regular season will then run through November. Reign will wrap up at Orlando on November 2nd. So we'll see whether they're playing for playoff positioning by that point.
Shout down to Doug Christie.
Because he didn't want to play for the Sonics?
Yeah, it's fucking bullshit.
I mean, it got the Sonics Sam Perkins. Why are we unhappy about it? It was great.
I know, but still, it's the principle. We could still be mad about it on principle and happy about it on outcome, right?
I suppose.
Are we not a process-based podcast? Yeah, the outcome worked out, but...
So because we did not have an interruption for you to go pick up Luca from school, we're going to have to do some research on the fly here. As we get into the UW women's basketball section, they have played three games since we last recorded. Last Wednesday at Michigan, suffered an 82-69 loss that was previously their most lopsided of the season, trailing 19-7 after one quarter. They did claw back within 10 after halftime, but got no closer as the Wolverines led by as many as 20 before a late UW run. Despite Xavier Seller scoring a season-high 30 points on 10 of 20 shooting, mentioned earlier, as Kelsey Plum's jersey was retired against Purdue, Huskies took a 12-2 lead to start the game, led by 27-9 after the first quarter, and their largest conference win since Plum's senior year. Both Sellers and Elladine shot 9 of 13 from the field, combining for 45 points in that one. Well, Daniels had a double-double of 14 points and 10 rebounds, and Eke scored 12 points on 6 of 7 shooting. But the Huskies had a much harder time of it Wednesday, as the national runners-up Iowa visited without Caitlin Clark, without their former coach Lisa Bleeder, who retired after the season, but still plenty of talent on a roster led by their longtime assistant Jane Jensen, including Villanova transfer Lucy Olson, who went off for 20 points in this one, as Iowa basically dominated from start to finish in what became the Huskies' most lopsided loss of the season. And the page is not loading for me to list the final score here, which I want to say was 87-64. It was something along those lines. And Xavier Sellers, who's really been in a good run for the Huskies during Big Ten play, all of her points, I think 13 of them, but only scored in the fourth quarter. It was 85-61, the final of this one, and a meaningful one because Iowa was also one of the last four teams in Charlie Kuhn's bracket projections before this game alongside the Huskies. So to lose badly at home, not a great shape for the Huskies.
Yeah,
not
considering
a great
where they rank on Bart Torvik, that's not a good loss for how badly that was.
It was a pretty shocking outcome, but the Huskies will have a chance to bounce back against another team in kind of the same range. A rare Monday home game next week against the Indiana Hoosiers, who have made five consecutive NCAA tournaments. They're 4-3 in conference play so far, gave USC a tough test in a 73-66 home loss on Sunday.
Is it kind of wild for you to see KenPom rankings being so prominent in broadcasts now?
It's happened slowly over a period of time, so I can't say it terribly surprises me, but it is interesting. It's interesting that there's so much a fixture, and there are understandable reasons for it, in a way that no advanced stats are in the NBA side. You know?
Well, it's just, I mean, for the NBA, most of the teams play most of the teams. Like, college relies on...
Exactly. These kind of third-party sites.
Yes.
But even, like, you know... They're constantly citing their offensive efficiency on KenPom on broadcast, and you don't hear offensive rating as often, I think, on NBA broadcasts.
Did you make?
No. I wouldn't take credit for that one.
Okay.
All right, UW men. Since we've last recorded, it's been a while. Last Wednesday, it lost 69-58 at home versus Purdue, a game they led 30-22 at halftime, but then outscored 26-6 over the first 10 minutes of the second half, going down double digits for good. Did you watch this one?
Some of it. It feels like it was opposite NFL playoffs, right?
No, it was a Wednesday.
It was a Wednesday? I don't know. It feels like it was an eternity ago.
It does. I agree.
I definitely did watch some of this, though, and I think maybe I started the second half and it was like Purdue started to pull away and I was like, this just isn't happening.
It was a terrific game from Great Osabor, who had 28 points on 8 of 9 shooting, making all five of his threes pretty shockingly for an iffy 3-point shooter, plus 9 rebounds and 3 steals. Mekhi Mason, the only other Husky to score double figures in that one. Huskies, again, part of the reason they were up so big at halftime was, again, benefiting from poor opponent three-point shooting at Heck Ed, as Purdue went 3 of 13, but the Boilermakers shot 60% inside the arc as they dropped the Huskies to 1-6. Then Tuesday night at Purdue, it was a game the Huskies, again, came out strong, led much of the way, but kind of a predictable collapse down the stretch of this one. In fact, so predictable that Zach Jabal lamented it even before I think it actually happened in the Discord. Do you not think that's fair?
No, it is fair. It's not a predictable collapse necessarily. I think that is probably the right way to put it, I suppose. But at home, usually the better team wins. So I think...
Yeah.
That's kind of the reason it was predictable, more than this is a unique Husky thing, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that, yeah. I mean, the Huskies tied it at 62 with a little under 6 minutes left, and then after that, it was an 11-2 Oregon run.
This game was closer than 82-71. This was a close game down to under 4 minutes in that range, something like that. Like, there are some moments... They're just such a frustrating
team. I mean,
team.
They were only down 5 at 73-68 inside the last 2 minutes.
Yeah, so it was close. Again, like, the score doesn't necessarily indicate how close this game was. I thought UW played pretty well in this game overall. And there are just a few little bits where you can be like, they're just kind of not quite put together right, this team overall.
Yeah.
And I think Danny Sprinkle, for what it's worth, given the roster, and I understand Great Osabor is getting like big NIL money, like these are not like unknown players overall, but, and I think I said this earlier, like we're not, being 1-7 in conference still doesn't feel bad. And
because again, they have not played a team ranked lower than, I believe, 31 on KenPom.
Yeah, I mean, they showed it on the broadcast, the KenPom rankings of
yes,
how good everybody they've played.
Oh,
is.
No, I'm sorry. Friday, UCLA is number 31. That will be the easiest game they have played in the month of January.
And they've really, for the most part, aside from the Michigan road trip, which we kind of knew, like, we knew that road trip was really difficult, to go down to the team down south, who's been playing well, despite the fact that it being fraudulent, had to be as close as they were as deep into the second half. It's one of those things that if you're following it closely and you know, you're like, it's all a little bit smoke and mirrors. Like, this game shouldn't be as close as it is, I think. But some of the things they do well, they really have found a way to exploit a little bit in these games. Gradius Amor's finishing, I thought, was better. The three-point shooting, I was like, don't do that. Thrillhelm had a very nice game. At least early, he was the one who kind of helped them get out to that early start. I think he scored like 7 points in the first 5-6 minutes and then didn't really score much after that.
Yeah, finished with 9 points.
I thought Zoom had a great game. Tyler Harris.
I think one of his better games. I mean, 18 points and 7 of 9 shooting on the road as a freshman.
And the efficiency, too. The fact that he was able to do it as efficiently, because there are players who could do what he does by taking a ton of shots, and that's just not exactly who he is. Tyler Harris really frustrates me defensively, but there was one shot that I just was so frustrated. I think the Huskies were down 3 in that period where it was like, right when it was around like 3-5, and he had an open 3, and then he passed it up and it turned into a turnover. And I was just like, ugh. There's just like these little moments that the team has. That's what it is when you're just not as good of a team, is right. Little things are going to happen and you're going to
lose. You don't
have
the margin for error.
Yeah. So none of it was surprising. Seeing how little they got from the bench, even though I generally like DJ Davis.
Still coming back from injury.
The 3-point shooting not exactly being there, but the kind of like interchangeable pieces of the Huskies, they didn't get much of anything from those. Because to me, it's like Mekhi Mason, Louis Courtright, Iheanacho, maybe a little bit of Tyler Harris, although he's a little bit different. Like those three players.
I think Harris is in a different class.
And he's also got the length that those other players don't have. But like Iheanacho, Courtright, and Mason, if they don't get anything from those three players, they're probably going to lose. And that's kind of how it feels. It's like, those are like the X factor. Like, Great is going to do about what he's going to do. Zoom had a better game than he normally is going to. But if they get something from those three, if they get a good performance from one of those three, then all of a sudden they're in it. But if they get, and they got basically nothing over, I mean, all between those three players, it was 4 points total. So, and, you know, the shoot, like, Mekhi Mason didn't even really shoot, but Courtright being 2-for-6, Iheanacho being 0-for-2, just like, they need those types of players to have big games, to beat teams like the team from down south. But overall, I thought, again, Danny's got these boys playing. Like, that's kind of the thing that I took away from it, which was, the amount that I've paid attention to college basketball, I guess it's only January. It feels like February, we played so many games, but that they've played this many big games, and that by the end of it, they haven't like given up. They're still fighting. They played a lot of really good fucking teams, and they're still going into Eugene and being in it till the very end. This team is going, they're going to win some games the rest of the season that people will be a little surprised by. They're going to beat some of these bad teams because they've been very ready for it.
Oh, there's not that many bad teams, just to be clear.
I wish the schedule was like a little, like that Seattle U loss never happens if they go through this gauntlet first, you know? And I think that's the frustrating thing about it. It's like the worst loss of the season happened before they were really ready for it. And I think they've shown in Big Ten play, they're pretty, pretty battle tested now. So they're going to pick off some teams. I hope that they make it to the Big Ten tournament.
I think that is very unlikely at this point.
Really? My God. How many good teams could there be?
I mean, so 14 teams make the conference tournament. The 14th best team on KenPom is, I believe, rated 60th in the country.
I mean, but games-wise, games back in the conference, they're a game back of Nebraska and Minnesota, two games back of Rutgers.
Yeah, they need to pass both of them. Like, they need to be in the top, to be in the top 14, you need to have 3 wins at this point.
It's so hilarious how few wins that actually is that you need. But when it's like, there are a lot of teams between 1 and 3. The Huskies are obviously last, and they've had the hardest schedule of anybody, I assume. But between
they
Minnesota.
Have, yes.
Why does this always happen? Minnesota, Nebraska, Rutgers, Northwestern, Ohio State, Iowa, Penn State. The Huskies have notably not played a single one of those teams yet. Correct?
No.
They haven't played a single team in the bottom half of the Big Ten. So it may feel like the Big Ten is an unstoppable conference, but it is not. There are easier games to come.
A couple. So I mean, they'll win some games, but I don't think they're going to make it to, I believe, Indianapolis this year. I mean, so again, yeah,
that's a little too negative to go that far. Wait, I mean, just because,
like, Ken Palm has the projected records. The 14th best projected record is 8-12. They're projected to go 5-15. I don't know what to tell you, Chief. They're probably not going to make it.
Who's projected to go 8-12?
Iowa,
Minnesota, Iowa.
Who's the 60th best team on KenPom? That's the floor for the Big Ten tournament.
Okay, they're winnable games in here though. Versus Nebraska is winnable. Versus Northwestern, they could sweep those two games.
Yeah, well, Nebraska is not projected to make it, and they're the 50th best team in KenPom. So I agree it's winnable. But like, really, like teams that are good enough to win the NIT are not going to play in the Big Ten tournament.
This is wild.
How I mean, this is our new reality.
This isn't always the case. This is a very good Big Ten.
I agree that this is an unusually deep Big Ten. I mean, because I'm sure there was a team outside the top 100 last year in KenPom. Yeah, I mean, last year Rutgers was 100 and Michigan was 128.
They need to win this UCLA game coming up. I think the Oregon game on March 9th, like, it's a W. That's a W right there.
Oh,
they're going to pick off some of these other games. And they'll probably lose one of at Ohio State or at Penn State or something. I don't know. I personally feel better about where this team is at right now and their chances to get in the mix. Again, I love that we're talking about the NCAA tournament. We're talking about making the Big Ten tournament is the goal right now. And I still feel good about it. I feel good about the year that Danny Sprinkle has had. So,
no, I think you're right. Like, you know, this was very predictable in terms of the strength of the Big Ten. And in terms of the turnover,
they probably should have zero wins. Well, no, they should have beaten USC. Is what the reality is. They should have beaten USC back in.
Right.
But
all right. So rematch Friday against the Bruins team. They got a 69-58 win at Pauley Pavilion in their opening Big Ten game for both of these teams in December. That was part of a 10-1 start to the season for UCLA that quickly went south with a 4-game losing streak to start January. A brutal travel schedule took the Bruins to Lincoln, then back home just as the fires were beginning in the LA area, to College Park, Maryland, Piscataway, New Jersey that subsequent weekend. UCLA lost all four of those games, and Mick Cronin ripped the referees after, I think, multiple of them, but you know, particularly after the game at Rutgers. They then snapped the losing streak last Friday, hosting Iowa and beat Wisconsin at home on Tuesday, and now get, you know, a much more reasonable trip up the West Coast to face UW. Bruins mediocre offensively, but number 12 in the nation in adjusted defensive efficiency, and they lead the Division 1 in forcing turnovers. Osibor had 8 against UCLA, although the Huskies as a team had just 12, not a particularly notable total. And then I think the big thing you look at with UCLA is just the size, even though they don't, you know, they start Ade Mara, who goes, I want to say 7-3. Yeah. He doesn't play a ton of minutes. You know, it is a lot of Tyler Bilodeau is 6-9 at center, but they have the ability to cause the Huskies some problems with their size.
It's pretty close to a must-win game, though, as far as the Big Ten tournament goes.
Yeah, I'm going to agree.
Would you agree with that? I've just been, I mean, obviously, I guess it worked a little bit, but kind of sick of the Mick Cronin, just the complaining about having to travel in that way. Just like, okay, cool.
Like,
sorry,
everybody's got to do it.
It really is like, I mean, you took the job. I know that it wasn't Mick Cronin's choice to join the Big Ten, but you know, the UCLA, they're the team that's not supposed to be there.
Other UCLA coaches decided to just leave their job and take an assistant yeah. coach job.
He could have been an offensive coordinator at any of these teams, Mick Cronin. Would have been easy.
Congrats to Chip Kelly.
Yeah, no. Somehow Chip Kelly, again, time is the biggest aim. or Redemptor. The fact that I'm like, Chip Kelly is like trolling the Oregon, just like, it's not as easy when you don't have 12 men on the field. And I'm like, yeah, Chip, good. I'm like, somehow Chip Kelly has gone from full circle to, I'm like, that seems pretty good.
As long as he's not our offensive, or, you know, the Seahawks offensive coordinator, I think we're good with Chip Kelly.
Yeah. I mean, I would take him as the Huskies offense. Obviously, Jed's got that locked down, but like,
right.
I think he did a pretty freaking good job this year.
No, it's hard to dispute. All right, UW football news. Let's start with the transfer edition, Penn State wide receiver Omari Evans, who clearly fills the void left by Jonte Cook II leaving the program, as we talked about on last week's pod, and comes in with considerably more experience than, you know, nearly anyone else that the Huskies have at receiver other than Denzel Boston. I mean, he has considerably more experience, frankly, than Denzel Boston. He played 16 games this year and 38 in 3 years at Penn State. As a starter this year, had 21 catches for 415 yards, 5 touchdowns. Not a team that, you know, wanted to throw the ball particularly, and when they did, it was obviously mostly to their tight end. But Evans was the big play threat for them, averaged 19 yards per reception over his 3 years at Penn State, 20 yards per reception this season with 5 touchdowns. And that's the element that the Huskies were looking for in this offense with Giles Jackson's graduation.
Giles Jackson is it. That's like, basically, can Omari Evans be the next Giles Jackson on this team? And I like that they replaced him. You knew that there'd be other wide receivers coming in. But he's not somebody who, he didn't have the pedigree necessarily that Jonte Cook had. But I think is somebody who contributions wise, he's done it. He's done it on the field. A lot less concerns about him overall than we had with Jonte Cook. And I think maybe a little bit underrated right now. So I'm excited about this signing. He's going to have an impact on the field next year. It's going to be Omari Evans and Denzel Boston.
Yeah, I think that's very likely. Yeah. And then
he's going to catch a lot more passes than he caught at Penn State.
It seems like a safe bet. And then you look at Kevin Green Jr. in the slot, and all three of those players have college experience. And
Rasheed
then,
Williams.
Yeah. But Rasheed Williams doesn't have a lot of experience.
No, I'm not saying experience, but he's going to be involved as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they'll add another receiver too.
I don't know if they necessarily will add another receiver, because I do think they're excited about a lot of the young talent they have coming in at receiver, but you just didn't want to have to like count on those guys. Having them be a bonus if they produce is a different situation. On the other side, the Huskies saw Thaddeus Dixon commit to North Carolina as a transfer. I mean, I know, you know, UW was still in the mix. I got to say, I didn't hold out a lot of hope for him to stay here after the Takario Davis news. Maybe I was alone on that one.
No, you weren't. I think people generally knew. But like, it's fine. Go to North Carolina, or go to North Carolina. It's like, that's fine. All things considered, there's familiarity. They obviously, you know, I'm sure that they'd spent very well for him. It was somebody that Steve Belichick wanted there. And they have the position, I don't know North Carolina's corners, but like the position's open more than it is here. UW is fine. That's not a luxury that most programs can have, is having three corners like that. There's a reality.
And one of the things I've been thinking about is, like, because of history, we still lump Nickelback in with cornerbacks. And like, yes, there are some players that can travel back and forth between those positions, but honestly, I think Nickelback is, in the modern college game, is more akin to safety than it is to cornerback anyway. So this idea that, well, why don't they just play all of Dixon, Davis, and Ephesians Prysock, that never really made any sense to me.
Let me ask
different
you a question.
Skill sets.
If that's the case, so Devin Witherspoon's 5th pick in the draft, right?
Yes.
If he's drafted as a slot, if that's a separate position, can a slot corner be a valuable enough position to be, or is it a more valuable position? It's almost like the bastard child of corners, where it's like outside corners are everything, but maybe you have more of an impact on a game in the same way that like JSN is like a great slot receiver, right?
Yeah.
Being the slot, like, we almost have to rethink how we judge these positions.
Of course.
In the sport. Because it is interesting where you're saying it's more akin, because you would probably never say that drafting a safety at pick 5 is the right way to allocate resources. Is it then more valuable than a safety because you're getting the value of a corner and a safety?
That's how I view it. I mean, you know, the thing that makes Witherspoon a little different is he disproves my point, because he is capable of going from outside cornerback when you're in a base defense to playing in the slot when you're in a nickel personnel. And so, you know, he's on the field for 100% of plays. That's what makes part of what makes him so valuable.
Is
but
that
yeah,
not,
I think,
like, basically at this point, like, nickel is the base defense, though, you know, like,
yes, it's the primary defense, but still the tradition is to call it base.
Yeah. With three wide receivers, like, you have three wide receivers on the field every single play.
not every play, but it's very rare the team for whom that's not the most common personnel grouping. So, yeah, I mean, I think what makes separates him is, like most guys that you're drafting as safeties, they're probably not going to be involved as plays as frequently as a, you know, a nickel like Devin Witherspoon, who, you know, is involved in both coverage and run stopping and blitzing, you know, all those sorts of things. I mean, Jalen Ramsey, the way that the Rams used him has always been kind of my model for Witherspoon. All right, one little last bit of UW football news. They have hired Odeh alum Taylor Mays as their new safeties coach. Mays had spent the last last season as an assistant DB coach at his alma mater, USC, after first joining the Trojans in 2022 as an analyst, played six seasons in the NFL, and I had kind of forgotten that his dad went to UW, so this is a homecoming of sorts, although he went down to USC to play for Pete Carroll rather than staying here in Seattle.
He's coaching the Seahawks.
Huh?
Did the Huskies hire him?
Huskies hired him.
Okay, never mind, sorry.
Yeah.
When you were saying it's a homecoming, I've always loved Taylor Mays, though. It's so funny because looking back on that draft, we wanted Taylor Mays. We didn't know who the fuck Earl Thomas was.
Right.
Obviously, Pete was right. Or unless you want to look at time as the only hater.
I still think that worked out.
on the field, Pete was right. But always loved Taylor Mays. And having him come back home, I think, is awesome. Similar position. Definitely room to grow the staff. It was interesting just thinking about, there's still this Jed Fish philosophy of like, and I know Ryan Walters, I think he's mostly been college, if I recall correctly.
But I think exclusively. I don't think he's worked in the NFL at all.
Taylor Mays has been working college, but having NFL experience, I still think is an important piece to it for Jed and that staff. Had they overlapped at any point?
At USC?
Or just anywhere?
No, I don't think there's any specific ties.
Okay, this is just, it made sense. There's still that USC UW thing. It is kind of funny of them as like our secondary rival. And I wish it was a little bit more protected, but there's just such a back and forth between these two schools, whether it comes to like Quincy Pondexter, obviously athletic directors, coaches, players like that.
Let's see. Yeah, Jed Fish was with the Jaguars in addition to the Seahawks during Taylor Mays' NFL career, but I don't believe that is one of the teams that Taylor Mays ever played for. Yeah, no, so I don't think so.
It's probably just something that made sense.
Yeah. All right, Seahawks. Let's start with updates on the offensive coordinator search. Rumblings, I guess this is report to the reports level that the Seahawks are considering making Hank Fraley their offensive coordinator and pairing him with somebody else who would kind of be in charge of overseeing the passing game. Scott Turner was specifically the person who was mentioned in that regard, son of Norv. So, you know, in interesting, like not necessarily the direction I think that we were thinking, you know, when we talked with Mike Sean Dugard the other night in terms of someone who has any experience calling plays at the NFL level, but it does sort of fit, ironically, given that it doesn't, because Ryan Grubb was an offensive line coach before he became an offensive coordinator. But in terms of going the opposite direction of someone who they were unhappy was passing the ball too much, hiring an offensive line coach does seem to shift a direction more towards a focus on running the ball, I suppose. If that happens, obviously it hasn't happened yet.
I was trying to see what the latest was. I don't know if there's been anything more today after the chatter yesterday. I'm a little skeptical about this. I'm also a little skeptical about breaking it up into the two positions where it's passing game coordinator, offensive coordinator, because there's a power divide there. You know, like the offensive coordinator is the person in charge, and my preference still would be to have the passing game coordinator. Like, who's calling plays at that point?
Scott Turner does have NFL play calling experience for the record.
Is it Hank Fraley who's calling plays because he's offensive coordinator?
Well, they haven't even done this, so who knows?
It's a pass, and it's like, all right, tap you in now, Scott. I
always kind of assumed that the run game, pass game coordinator thing was a little bit of like title inflation in the NFL rather than like, yeah, I suppose there's, you know, when you're calling, designing the play concepts, there probably is some benefit to, no, I don't think that, no, I think you'd want the same person doing all of that. I don't know.
It feels a little clunky to me. I don't love the idea of I'm sure there are situations where this has worked, but kind of piling on with the hot team and going, I mean, we're digging, obviously, like, it's people are getting the next job up. Hank Fraley is getting the next job up. I haven't heard about Tanner Engstrom. I assume Tanner Engstrom's going to be the offensive coordinator for the...
By the way, by the hot team, you mean the Las Vegas Raiders, where Scott Turner was interim OC last year.
It's not what I'm talking about, but okay.
I didn't realize that he had a Michigan tie. He spent a year under Jim Harbaugh as an analyst.
Scott Turner definitely... It's so hard to look at Scott Turner's resume and say... Because he was offensive coordinator... Was it with Vegas?
He was just interim OC with
but
Vegas.
But before then, he was an offensive coordinator for 2 years beforehand.
For 3 years with the football team / Commanders.
Okay. So I guess that North Turner ties make sense too. I just have a hard time understanding whether any of this matters. Like, I know it does matter, but in the end, the skill level versus talent piece of coordinators, there are choices you make in the NFL. And I think this is what we saw. Every choice that you make gains or costs you win probability throughout the game. And ultimately, I think if you looked at it statistically, almost every run costs you win probability. Would you agree with that statement?
I mean, I want to investigate this issue more closely. The argument that Zach Jabal has made on the Discord, Third Problem Brothers Zach Jabal, is that, like, if you look at the best teams, best offenses in the NFL, even accounting for game situation, they were relatively run heavy this year. The thing that fascinates me is, like, usually there's a disconnect between this team is good at running, but they can't pass at all. You know, that's that sort of team. And then you can sort of, like, understand which is more important, running or passing. This year, I don't feel like that disconnect existed. Like, the teams that were good at running were typically good at passing, and vice versa.
A lot of those teams also had running quarterbacks as well.
Fair. That's true, and that's a big factor in it. But I do wonder if it's almost like becoming a more trivial distinction because, you know, you can either pass to set up the run or run to set up the pass. Like, they're both influencing the other. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I am skeptical right now on the lessons that Hank Fraley learned in Detroit. In the same way, I mean, like, when Mike Shaughn was like, I don't give a shit what my bosses said and what my bosses did. So I do kind of love this idea that it's like, yeah, he's coming from the
Lions. Yeah, I mean, like, you can look at this as a graph. It is almost, you know, but there is a straight line between rushing and passing efficiency this year. Other than the Eagles, you know, were very good at rushing and only okay at passing, only good at passing. But, you know,
who were good at rushing were also good at passing.
The next five best teams other than the Eagles were the Ravens, the Bills, the Lions, the Commanders, and the Buccaneers. Guess what? Those were also the top five passing teams.
That is very fascinating. I think that's a unique situation. I guess there's quarterbacks in there, right?
Dolphins were an outlier. They were very bad at rushing this season, even though they were generally pretty good at passing, you know, obviously because of the 2A period of time. The Raiders were unusually terrible at rushing relative to their merely bad passing. Those are like the two biggest outliers, but it is shockingly close to a straight line.
That good offenses were good offenses this year.
Yes.
It wasn't like one or the other. No, I think that's a fascinating thing to look at. And maybe those two things are converging a little bit more. I just still feel like and granted, a lot of those offense, I don't know, what is Liam Cohen's background?
I think he was a quarterback coach.
Okay.
He worked with, he was in the Rams tree for a long period of time.
Who are the OCs of those teams, I guess, is what I'd ask. Todd Monken.
That's asking a lot. Yes.
I can't remember. Who's the Bills one who took over for Ken Dorsey?
The Bills offensive coordinator is, I want to say, Joe Davis?
Joe Brady.
Okay.
quarterbacks coach. Another quarterbacks coach, Liam Cohen, quarterbacks coach.
I mean, it's one of those things where, like, such a high percentage of offensive coordinators have been quarterback coaches that it's
Kellen Moore is another one.
Well, probably the bad offenses had coordinators with quarterback coach backgrounds as well, you know?
Yes.
You can't really separate.
Ben Johnson definitely was a quarterback's coach, right?
I don't know if he ever was. Was he? I believe he coached wide receivers before he became the offensive coordinator.
Tight ends, wide receivers. Okay.
And tight ends, yeah.
Wait, who are the other teams? So it was Bills. I love how
Washington,
old Todd Monken is compared to all these people.
Cliff Kingsbury, obviously, quarterback background.
Todd Monken's been like an OC just for so long that you have to go back to. He was passing game coordinator and wide receivers in like the early 2000s, mid 2000s. You said Cliff Kingsbury, quarterback background. All of them are coming from a background in the pass game. And I feel like there's a structure to it. How about that? Is how you view these things, how they correspond to each other. If you are of the mindset, which I'm not, Hank Fraley might not be this. This is overjudging his background.
Because again, Ryan Grubb came from an offensive line coaching background.
I think Ryan Grubb is hard to separate from Kalen DeBoer, for what it's worth. But
was Kalen DeBoer a quarterback coach? I really don't even remember.
I know he's the Indiana OC, right?
Yeah, but like back when he was a position coach.
Offensive coordinator, quarterbacks with Fresno State.
Yeah.
Same at Eastern. Wide receivers at Southern Illinois. There's a consistency to these things. I understand there aren't that many offensive line coaches who have been offensive coordinators, but the thinking is all these coordinators understand that these things work in unison with each other, right? As you've illustrated. It's about what are we prioritizing here? And if you're viewing this from the Pete Carroll perspective, which again, I've talked very positive about Pete Carroll as a head coach. And look, his fucking offensive coordinator, the one offensive coordinator, I feel like there are a couple. One offensive coordinator that things really worked for a second there is now about to be a head coach somehow.
But also passed too much for his taste.
It seems like that's going to be done, which is kind of wild. An incredible turn of events. I still think they're all coming from pretty similar backgrounds, which is we've talked about this in the NFL. The largest portion of your cap is going to one position. It's the same with the Seahawks. It's the same with almost every team, right? You have one player that you spend most of your money on, and then you got everybody else, right? Having the person who has that person's intent and perspective in mind, Hank Fraley has never been a quarterback at any place. Maybe he was in high school. I don't know. I doubt it.
It seems unlikely.
Hank Fraley has never been a quarterback, though. And all of these people are thinking from the perspective of receivers and quarterbacks generally. I would guess a lot of them were quarterbacks when they were younger. That is the perspective that they're thinking. We're spending so much fucking money, or portion of the cap, on Geno Smith. Mike Sean talked about how he thinks that they should extend Geno Smith, that Mike McDonald's on the same page. If you're hiring a coach to run the damn ball, I don't think it makes sense structurally for what you're trying to do. And I also think that, no offense to Charles Cross, he's not Pene Sewell. Like, and there probably will not be a time, and I also, some offense to Ken Walker, he's not Jahmyr Gibbs. Like, you could say what you want about running backs and their mattering, but Jahmyr Gibbs stood out as a running back for the Lions.
I mean, certainly he's someone they invested a lot of draft capital in.
Gibbs or Walker?
Tanner Engstrand and Mark Brunell, the two main candidates to replace Ben Johnson per Locked On Seahawks host Corbin Smith. We were wondering about Mark Brunell.
I think, who knows? It remains to be seen. I think this is a miss, though. I think this is a knee-jerk reaction to Ryan Grubb passing the ball too much. And we're not, same as Mike Sean said, what do you do if you get a yard on first down? What do you do if you lose 2 yards on first down? Maybe it'll make the offensive line good. But if that's it, again, the shit that we're talking about that I said about Mike McDonald, if you have to hire a head coach to make your defense good, you've structured your team wrong. If you have to hire an offensive coordinator to make your offensive line good, you've structured your team wrong. And I think that's the piece that I keep coming back to. Those people should be elevating the quarterback, right? Those people should be making the position that is by far the most important position on the field. You can look at all the teams that
are
remaining.
Pete Carroll was elevating the quarterback?
I think Pete Carroll cared about the quarterback more than people give him credit for.
I agree that he cared about the quarterback a lot. That's wasn't the question I asked.
Got in trouble by maybe caring about the quarterback too much. I think Pete Carroll is pretty aware of the importance of the quarterback position.
But I don't think that Hank Fraley is like, no, I don't know. Maybe they did just win with Jared Goff, so you never know. But then they did lose in the playoffs. I don't know if you saw that game with Jared Goff. Again, they haven't even hired him. We're pre-evaluated decision that hasn't even been made. But,
I think they fucked this one up. But we'll see. It seems like there's a lot of smoke around it. How about that?
There's a lot of smoke.
I'll shit on the hire when it happens.
There you go. Did you want to say anything else about the Mike Shon interview coming out of that?
It's actually funny coming back to this because it's the range of emotions about this team because we left that conversation and I immediately was like, I feel pretty good about Mike McDonald after the conversation that we had with Mike Shon. I think the number one takeaway that it seems like Mike Shon has to summarize is pretty similar to what I was saying on our season recap podcast, which is I think John Schneider is in a different pocket than everybody else. I think he has not necessarily structured the team right overall. And at the same time, doesn't have reasonable expectations for what the team can be. And Mike McDonald did his damnedest to get them there. That's kind of to summarize the last year. And I left that conversation with Mike Shon being like, all right, I feel pretty good about Mike McDonald going forward.
Did you feel leave the conversation feeling good about John Schneider going forward?
Absolutely not. Do you?
No.
I mean, I don't mind the idea that Mike Shon was talking about, which is we're a team that's going to go into every year and try to win. But I kind of don't understand how they're going. Like, do they really think that Geno Smith is going to lead this team to a Super Bowl? Do they honestly deep down think that? Do they think that Geno Smith is going to be Super Bowl winning quarterback Geno Smith? Because I'm not sure that they believe that. And then at that point, what are you doing? Right? They're competing. Yes, they won 10 games. They could have won the NFC West. They should have won the NFC West. But do they really think that Geno Smith is going to be that? That's the piece that I'm having a hard time understanding of. Are we just competing for the sake of competing to not tear it down?
But if you're not willing to rebuild, by definition, you're just like, that's not your goal is to win a championship. Your goal is to be competitive. I mean, I guess that's probably not fair. I guess what I would say is maybe philosophically, you believe the way to win a championship is by being in the mix for a long period of time. And then, things just break right. But I don't think that's actually true in the modern NFL.
No, I agree. Who are the four teams that are left, right?
I mean, they are. Are you asking the question literally?
I mean, they're not necessarily the four best quarterbacks in the league, because I think maybe the three best quarterbacks in the league are all in the same conference. But this is a quarterback league, ultimately. Like, Jalen Hurts is probably the worst remaining quarterback overall. And four of them were drafted.
And notably, he's the only one who, wasn't a first-round pick.
I think it's the first pick of the second round or something, right? Like that, or early second round pick. All four of them were drafted. Three of them were first round picks. One of them was an early second round pick. A lot of the teams that were just eliminated this weekend who played very well, quarterbacks were the first pick in the draft, first round pick. Obviously, Lamar was underrated coming out of college, but same with Jared Goff. Like, we can shit on Jared Goff all you want. It's literally the first pick in the draft. And there's obvious talent for Jared Goff, and he had a very good season. Same with Baker Mayfield. Like, if you're never, that's the thing that I'm having a hard time understanding, the lessons that John Schneider learned from Green Bay, because the thing that Green Bay did forever, and still is doing this, is they kept making good quarterbacks. They've had fairly good quarterbacks, above replacement level quarterbacks since 1991.
And of course, during the Favre era, famously, we're repeatedly drafting quarterbacks in later rounds and then developing those guys into starters for other teams, including the aforementioned Mark Brunell.
Those organizations understood the importance of the quarterback position. And I think that's the piece that John Schneider is having a hard time with. And also, you don't get Patrick Mahomes, you don't get Lamar Jackson, you don't get Josh Allen if you never draft a quarterback. It is impossible. It is
very difficult to do.
So why they've been so consistent about this that, I mean, Sean Schneider having drafted, like, I would feel bad about myself if I got to this point in my career and I'm like, from Mike Sean basically being like, he is a quarterback's guy and he never has done it. It's like, damn, you only live once. You only get so many chances in life to go draft Josh Allen. You could talk about it after, but no one cares that you're like, in the mix, hang the trophy, hang the banner. Really thought about trading for Baker Mayfield. Really, really felt strongly about Josh Allen. And this is not even talking bad about Geno, but like this, they just have to think at some point about what's next. Because if Geno Smith, again, if Geno Smith was 25 years old, then the Seahawks would be in an amazing position overall.
They'd be in a good position. They wouldn't be in an amazing position.
I don't, with the way that Geno has played, if he'd, we'd be like, wow, that's a really exciting young player. But also you'd be projecting growth too.
Okay, well, let's say if he's 30 years old. Because it's not about the growth versus not growth. It's about the fact that at some point you do have to consider the possibility of decline.
I think he's not that far off from Jimmy Garoppolo. Like, I think that Geno Smith is not that far off from quarterbacks. And he's also maybe not that far off from like the top 10. But just to... I also kind of agree with Mike Sean about running into next year and just running it back. But I'm like, what's the difference in this team? Like, ultimately, some of the young players get a year older. Geno is also a year older. DK is a year older. You know, like, players are starting to decline. Tyler Lockett's probably gone. There's some cap casualties. There are a few draft picks, but it's not an amazing draft pick that they're going to be bringing in that you would expect to completely change the team. You have to hope that the defense gets a lot better. And then Hank Fraley is going to be the one. Hank Fraley is going to be the person to take this team from being a pretty marked tier four of the NFL, something like that, to all of a sudden pushing them in the place of winning a Super Bowl. I don't buy it. And that's the thing is, like, I don't think that is Mike McDonald's fault, though, I guess is what I'm saying. I think this is a John Schneider issue, is that, like Mike Sean is saying, they haven't properly assessed the team as it is.
Agreed.
Right?
Yeah.
So I like, in a vacuum, I like Geno Smith as a player and I like Geno Smith as the quarterback of the Seahawks, but there's also a reality of the players that are around him, the resources that they have. They're spending money. They're spending resources. It's not like we can all say to ourselves that it's a rebuilding team, but it's kind of not a rebuilding. You know, again, I've said this over and over again. They're not structured like a rebuilding team, whether we say it or not. And they haven't done enough. So, and I don't know if I buy Hank Fraley is the answer to that either. So it's funny. I literally left that conversation feeling good. And now I'm like, we'll see.
Well, they don't call you some chicks, Tristan.
I contain multitudes. Earlier this week, I felt one way. This time this week, I don't feel that way anymore. So on that note.
Thanks for listening.
I was like, I know that you're intending on recording this because you're doing it in podcast voice.
Oops, all asides, the Pelton Cast episode. So on the Discord, there was a discussion about Rubens.
The bruise or the sandwich?
The sandwich.
Okay.
And specifically the corned beef spot that is right by where you used to work near Seattle's historic Paramount
Hell
Theater.
Yeah. The one that says corned beef giant on it?
Yeah. And
I'm like, yes. They should just put a question mark by it, and the answer is yes, always.
Have you been there?
Absolutely, I have.
I still haven't ever been.
Market House is what I want to say. I've been a bunch of times. It's fucking incredible. Do you want to know how I know it's incredible?
Because it's been in existence that long a time?
No, the giant sign that says corned beef.
That's how I know it's incredible. Like, everything else in that area turns over, you know, constantly. But corned beef has been a constant. But anyways, that's not actually what this discussion is about.
Oh.
Even though there was a real zest for a search for Seattle's best Reuben, I feel like, on the Discord.
Okay. Are there enough Reubens to search for them?
I guess we'll find out. Maybe this is a Discord-initiated search rather than a PeltonCast-initiated search so that we can't abandon it. But
We have cookies. We're talking about cookies this week.
We are talking about cookies this week. We have already talked about cookies. This is at the end of the pod.
Oh.
It was referenced Second Avenue Deli in New York on the Discord. And It turned out that I ate there in 2013 when I was in New York to watch the Huskies play at Madison Square Garden with Paris Blackwell and CJ Wilcox, a team that also came up on the Discord recently. Like, you know, you never know what's going to come up on the Discord. So I went to go listen to our podcast from then to see whether I had referenced Second Avenue Deli, because I don't really remember what my experience was of eating, presumably a Reuben there, possibly a pastrami on rye. I don't know. And we didn't discuss it at all. But what I was most amazed about was we did a podcast with our cousin, Michael, as a guest.
Mughal?
We talked about the Thanksgiving foods, and we did this all in barely an hour. We talked about my trip to New York, like all of it, in barely an hour. Now the like after the pod is like an hour. We spent like 9 minutes talking about the Apple.
Pretty soon, this is going to be the podcast.
don't make promises we might keep. And then like 10 minutes talking about the Seahawks game during the middle of a season where they won the Super Bowl. Now we can't get through a podcast in under like an hour and a half, even when it's not football season.
Oh my God.
I guess have we gotten better at podcasting that much worse? All right.
Okay. That wasn't as fun as I thought it'd be.
I don't know why you thought it would be that fun.
I thought you'd have real takes. You've seen so many of these.
I'm Kevin Pelton. I don't have strong takes. I grade every trade
a B+.
That's
the best part of this whole segment. Your acknowledgement of not having takes. This is how the podcast ended up this way. I have to have all takes because you don't have takes.
No, you have to have takes. You don't have to change your takes every week. You don't have to 1 week be Mike McDonald is a defensive genius.
How much fun is it? First off, defensive genius has never been a word that has come out of my mouth about Mike McDonald. Second off.
In the next, I miss Pete Carroll. I wish the Seahawks are going for too many fourth downs now.
Here's the thing that people don't understand about all takes is that human beings contain multitudes.
I don't disagree with that.
You don't feel the same thing all the time, no matter the situation. This is a thing that I've been railing against for so fucking long. Is even in high school when they were like when we were in high school, like being fake was like the thing, right? That was like a distinctly late 90s, early.
So we are
going to
do a full hour after the pod now?
We could cut out all the Oscar talk. but that didn't need to be in there. But just start it where you said, I'm Kevin Pelton. There are no takes. I don't have takes. But it's like people change their perspective based upon the situation and more information becoming available.
I mean, I agree that, you know, the expression, what do you do when the facts change? Yes, I change my opinion, you know, but I don't know. I'm not quoting that very well. But the point is, you fluctuate to extremes.
I both think Danny Sprinkle is probably a pretty good coach for UW and also love Lorenzo Romar still.
Well, both those are not contradictory things.
But if you
Mike McDonald is
like,
a great hire and Mike McDonald is a terrible hire.
I never once said that Mike McDonald was a terrible hire. That's bullshit right there.
I'm
Kevin Pelton. I don't do takes. Your ESPN brain is kicking in. You don't do takes. You just have headlines. Frame things with headlines. To what you're saying. I never once said that Mike McDonald was a terrible hire. I think he's probably a pretty good hire. But I also, at the same time, am not convinced about Mike McDonald yet. It's funny that after the season that these two teams had, that the Huskies went, they were under 500 for the year, right?
That is correct.
And the Seahawks went 10-7, better than they were the year before. And I am way more convinced on Jed Fish than I am on Mike McDonald. Human beings contain multitudes, and I'm right.